Tiger Nation. I am Byron Hulsey, headmaster at Woodbury Forest School, and I would like to welcome you to the Woodbury podcast series. This podcast consists of informal yet substantive conversations with alumni, faculty, staff, and students. The conversations explore how Woodbury's core values empowered alumni to build a solid foundation for their lives, how those core values are taught today by Woodbury teachers, and how those values are put into practice by today's students. Thank you for joining us, and we hope you enjoy. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Woodbury podcast. We're joined today by Harry Levant, and Harry spoke at Woodbury back in April. He's a terrific guy. He's an attorney who, as he'll tell you himself, is a recovering gambling addict, and he now works in the very important field of treating those who are themselves addicted and also in support of the public health and prevention side of matters that understands and appreciates that many, many, many Americans will at some point in their lives gamble and hopefully not fall prey to the addiction that has challenged him and now challenges so many folks. So Harry, thank you for joining the Woodbury podcast. This is a topic that's very important nationally, and we'll hear all about that. It's also really important for us as a boys' boarding school because so many folks who gamble in our nation today are young men. So, Harry, thanks for joining us. Welcome to the Woodbury podcast.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for bringing me back to say hello to the Woodbury community and beyond. And if I just may, I have to correct just one thing from that lovely introduction. I am no longer a practicing attorney. I did go to law school. I practiced for 23 years, 22 of them I remember fondly, the last year, right, obliterated in the haze of my gambling addiction. I am, in fact, a disbarred attorney. I take my sanctions very seriously, and I just wanted to put that out there for everyone so that we have the actual, I have a doctorate in law and public health that I just earned from Northeastern University, but my law practice is behind me. I'm a disbarred lawyer related to my gambling addiction.
Duly noted. Thank you for the correction. Harry, why don't you tell us a little bit about your life, kind of where you're from, what it was like growing up for you, the twists and turns. Just give us a good bio here.
Be happy to. Born and raised in Philadelphia, now live in Boston, Massachusetts. Went to school in Philadelphia, made my first bet when I was, my first sports bet when I was 15 years old. Went to the casino for the first time when I was 16 years old. A lot of things I know now that I didn't understand then. It would take 30 years to fully recognize the magnitude of my own gambling addiction. But suffice to say, I never had a healthy relationship with gambling. And it all culminated in most of the year 2013. My gambling addiction became what could only be described as pathological. I was going to the casino 4, 5, 6 days and nights a week, 8, 10, 12 hours at a time. On the outside, I looked like a practicing attorney. On the inside, I was being torn apart by anxiety, depression, and it all manifested in an out-of-control pathological gambling addiction. There are very, very few absolutes in this world, very, very few. But I'll give you one right now. If a person stuck in the grips of a pathological gambling addiction says these four words, "I have a plan," you can be rock solid certain that plan is absolutely no good. And mine was no different. In April of 2014, I had a plan. I was going to try and find a way to win back all the money that I had misappropriated, that I had stolen from people I had previously represented. And if I couldn't win back that money, I would take my own life. And I made my last bet on April 27, 2014. On that same night, survived a near suicide attempt. Unfortunately, I had a moment of clarity in the haze of my addiction, called and asked for help. Began a journey in treatment and recovery, which included in February of 2015, pleading guilty to the financial crimes that I committed. Stood in the courtroom where I had practiced law for 2 decades, stood there as a defendant, took responsibility for my actions, and was sentenced to 11 and a half to 23 months in jail. but given by a sympathetic and understanding judge who understood the nature of addiction, given an opportunity to be placed on parole to continue my treatment. And on that day, the court said to me, Mr. Levant, this doesn't have to be the end. You can do something with this one day. And I made a vow that day in front of the clients I had betrayed, in front of the court where I had practiced, and the court that I had then betrayed, and in front of my children with tears going down their faces, I made a vow that if I could get well, and it was a very big if at that point in time, but if I could, I would devote the rest of my life to preventing other people from suffering the same fate, particularly other young men. And that led me in 2018 back to school to become a therapist. I went to LaSalle University in Philadelphia, earned a master's in professional clinical counseling, became an internationally certified gambling addiction therapist. And then in 2021, while I was practicing, I realized something more needed to be done on the prevention side. Went back to school one more time, Northeastern University in Boston, Massachusetts, earned a doctorate in law and public policy, and my research is all about bringing public health regulation to the out-of-control gambling industry. So now I do a little bit of public speaking. I was fortunate to come to your school to do some public speaking. I treat patients as a clinical therapist, and I direct gambling policy at the Public Health Advocacy Institute at Northeastern University School of Law, where we are leading the national effort to bring public health regulation to the gambling industry to make this thing safer.
Before you get into what you're doing today, it would be interesting, I think, to hear a little bit about what your recovery from addiction was like. What was, you say that you attempted suicide in a moment of clarity, asked for help. For that, we're obviously grateful. I know your family is, you are. That's still a long road of recovery. What happens? What's the recovery like? There must be some absolute saints in that world to care for folks who are really doubled over with the, as you note, the pathological addiction of gambling.
First of all, thank you for those kind words. There's really nothing kinder you could have said than expressing your own gratitude that I am here, and I thank you for that. Recovery is something I continue to live one day at a time. It is, some folks consider that to be a cliche. Those of us in the recovery world, those of us privileged to walk the journey of recovery, don't consider that a cliche. We consider it a mandate. I'm still a gambling addict. I'm not going to make a bet today. And when I get up tomorrow, I'm not going to make a bet tomorrow. I'm going to take it one day at a time. The people who touched me and continue to touch me in my journey, and Byron, there are some very, very, very dark days and dark nights in the early parts of that journey. When you truly find a path to recovery that I believe, and I believe this personally and I believe this clinically, recovery is based on three words: authenticity, meaning, and purpose. And I never compare one addiction to another. They're all horrifically painful. But one of the common threads I experience and that I see clinically is people who do well in recovery are living an authentic way. They've brought meaning to their lives and they are purpose-driven. And part of that purpose, sir, is being able to help other people. You can't do that in the beginning. In the beginning, it's more selfish. It's how do I care for myself? But it's that transition.
How long would you have considered yourself to be in that state before you were in a position to help others?
It was about 4 years. In fact, I had there were a lot of people who ran away from me at my lowest moments. But a childhood best friend, by the name of John, a prominent lawyer in Philadelphia and New Jersey, a prominent tax attorney, he ran back to me, and we become wonderful friends again. We had breakfast one morning. We would have breakfast twice a month. Just and in the beginning, it was hard to sit and look him in the eye. But in the spring of 2018, he said to me, I remember the words, he said, you don't owe anyone anything. If you just want to continue living your life, that's fine. But if you're really intent on trying to help other people, now's the time. Go do something with this. and see what you can do. And the director of my program at LaSalle University said the same thing. He pointed out to me, my story is less interesting than what I want to do with the journey.
Yeah.
And those words have really motivated me as well.
I have a good friend who's a recovering alcoholic, and he has struggled with his addiction over the years. And for him, he was able to turn the corner when he became a sponsor. And I think that's because, as you say, he found more meaning and purpose in his life than he had before. And it sounds like your story bears some similarity to that.
It truly motivates me. You know, I'm in no way, I said this to your students back in April, I'm not opposed to gambling. I can't do it. I'm an addict in recovery, but for many, it's a recreational activity. But what's much more important, people say, how do you overcome this? What's more meaningful, the next bet you want to make or being able to connect with others and be of service to others? To me, that's a very easy equation when you get right down to it.
One of the central subjects that you addressed back in April with the Woodbury Boys was the changed landscape for betting that has increased its prominence in our culture. Can you share with the listeners a little bit about what's different now than it was, say, 5, 10 years ago?
It seems every week, you and I were talking before we started recording, it seems every week I'm getting more and more calls from parents whose teenage children, young men and young women, but more young men who are struggling, and parents are finding that their children are struggling with sports gambling. Historically, sports in this country are part of our culture, part of our upbringing, part of our connection to one another, something that grandparents hand down to parents and hand down to children. For better or worse, sports have just always been part of our cultural and shared expectations. One need only drive onto the magnificent campus at Woodbury to see, you feel the love of sports.
Yeah, no doubt.
I had such a privilege to talk to many of your students, and I met many of your coaches, and we talked about that shared bond around sports and athletic achievement and the joy of competition. Well, historically, sports and gambling, you know, they were like oil and water. They don't go together.
Yeah.
And they certainly don't go together for children. Right. We've had a 180-degree shift. Sports and the sports industry has decided to partner with the gambling industry and partner with the AI and technology industry to sell their statistics to the gambling industry to create something called micro betting. So we've gone from a time where, and I'm gonna date myself here a little bit, but I'm old enough to remember when Willie Mays in the late 70s or early 80s appeared at a card show in Atlantic City, New Jersey, and was being threatened, and I think was actually banned from baseball for a short period of time for appearing at a show at a casino. Mm-hmm. Now, the sports leagues and the teams and the players and the owners sell the statistics, and the gambling industry turns them into instant micro betting on every phone. So you can now bet on the speed of every pitch. The 16-year-old brain, the 23-year-old brain, the 73-year-old brain isn't equipped to handle the speed of gambling on things like every pitch and every tennis serve and every golf club swing. So we're looking, Byron, at a new product that is fundamentally dangerous, and I respectfully submit, not safe for the public.
And it's all much more legal now. Walk us through some of that, the court's rulings.
Sure. In 2018, the United States Supreme Court decided a case called Murphy versus the NCAA. Murphy is the current governor of New Jersey, Bill Murphy. The case was actually started by Governor Chris Christie.
Right.
Started in the early 2010s-ish or so. New Jersey had a problem. Atlantic City was dying. Governor Christie wanted to bring sports gambling to Atlantic City, but they were blocked in doing so because there was a federal law called PASPA, the Professional and Amateur Sports Protection Act, that Congress had passed in 1992. And what PASPA said was, look, any state that as of 1992 hasn't legalized sports gambling, you can't have it. No, nobody else can have it. And back then in 92, there were only three states that had legalized sports gambling. Everyone knows Nevada. Great trivia question to open the school year. Name the other two. Nobody will get them. You want me to tell you?
Yeah.
Ruin it for the listeners. Oregon and Delaware had little pool courts. That was it. So Atlantic City was, New Jersey was blocked. And in some excellent legal work, team of lawyers in New Jersey supporting the governor sued and said, wait a minute, federal government, you have 50 children, not three. You can't give toys to three kids on Christmas morning and ignore the other 47. And the Supreme Court in the Murphy case held that PASPA was unconstitutional under the 10th Amendment and struck it down. This didn't legalize sports gambling nationwide. It merely opened the door. Yeah. And since then, in just 7 years, 39 states and the District of Columbia have legalized sports gambling. And here we are now betting on the speed of every baseball pitch. So there's a disconnect. Byron, this has happened so fast. And my work, along with my colleagues here at the Public Health Advocacy Institute, is designed to say, wait a minute, we're not opposed to gambling, but this thing is out of control. This is the wild, wild west. And young men are getting hurt. We got to do something about it.
What are some of the states that have not legalized gambling, and what's the rationale? It seems like they're just missing out on revenue.
See, that's the argument, Byron, of the gambling industry. Come on, it's the old argument.
Easy money.
Well, yes and no. If we take it back to our childhood, right? Remember, you would go home and say, I want to do what Johnny and Sally are doing. And your mother would say, well, if Johnny and Sally are going to jump off a bridge, are you going to do that?
Yeah.
It's a double-edged sword, right?
Yeah.
So the industry goes state by state and says, your neighbors are doing it, so should you. But what we're starting to see is the social cost of this. There's just a study out of UCLA and another one out of Northwestern that have found that bankruptcy filings are up by 30% in states that have legalized online sports gambling. I would suggest to your listeners, and I will send this to you, Byron, so you can make it available to anyone who wants it. There's a fantastic research article that came out last November in The Lancet that lays out why this is a public health issue and not as simple as, well, if one state has it, the neighbors need to have it too. But the specific answer to your question, there's three big states that have not yet legalized sports gambling. And that's going to be California, Texas, and Georgia. But they are in the sights of the gambling industry and the sports leagues.
Those states don't have a ton in common, but that's one thing, I guess. Isn't one argument for these states that it's generating state revenue for their budget?
I testified in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee back in December of 2024. Very first thing I said under oath to the Senate Judiciary Committee is I am not opposed to the properly regulated legalization of sports gambling.
Right.
Emphasis on the words properly regulated.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, what we're seeing state by state by state by state is the states can't keep up with the technology and the push of gambling. So what I believe we need are minimum federal safety standards. And states have to adhere to minimum federal safety standards, which is why I'm currently working with members of the Senate and the House in Washington, D.C. I've been privileged to help write a bill called the Safe Bet Act, which is designed, Byron, to create minimum safety standards. Once we have these minimum standards, and I'm happy to talk if you want about what a few of those proposals are, then states can do, if states want to make it even safer, that's great. But right now, we don't have any safety standards. So you're not going to draw me into advocating for Texas how to get gambling. Uh-uh. Good try, but no.
Well, I that was not my intent. I was just more trying to think through the rationale on the front end. And I do, it has to be about the money, but you won't need to comment on that. That sounds like a great
thing. I'm happy to comment on it, but from this perspective, we have now what I call the gambling establishment.
Yeah.
And the gambling establishment is comprised of the gambling companies, the leagues, the teams, the owners, the players.
And the universities.
The colleges and universities. The NCAA just did something back in April, right after I had the privilege of speaking at Woodbury. Couple of weeks later, the NCAA actually entered into a deal to sell bowl game and tournament statistics to the gambling industry to create more micro betting. And what's going on behind the scenes now, the Big Four conferences are negotiating their own data deals. This is dangerous. It means that we're going to have, 18-year-olds at their prom in June are going to be the subject of micro betting activity in September. It just doesn't make any sense.
No, it doesn't. But I mean, when sadly, the universities are getting starved for revenue from other sources, and so they're going to be inclined to look for it elsewhere. Unfortunately, I'm delighted though that you're engaged in this work with members of Congress, the House and the Senate, to look at some guardrails to make it safer. Tell us a little bit about what you're seeing and hearing about with regard to young men who may start out in a benign kind of way, just gambling for fun with small bets and, doing it socially and just kind of jacking around with it a little bit, I guess, for entertainment. And then how it can flip and switch for these kids or young folks or anyone who finds themselves, in your words, kind of pathologically consumed with this.
Great question. By the way, I happen to agree with you. I have great empathy for colleges and universities and state governments who are struggling for budgets, but you don't solve a problem by creating a new and different, bigger one.
You don't need to convince me, sir. I'm with you 100%.
So going to what we worry about, there's a fundamental recognition that we need to put in front of every listener right now, which is since 2013, medical science has recognized that gambling is an addictive product, just like heroin and opioids and tobacco and alcohol and cocaine. It is an addictive product. So when we talk about, where's the line? I'm not in any way, I'm not opposed to alcohol, I'm not opposed to gambling. However, for people who struggle, and this is what we worry about with younger men and women, it's not the money. It's the action. It's the way the product makes the person feel. And particularly for this audience, the risk reward system of the human brain isn't fully developed till you're 26 years old. So what we're seeing happen is, ooh, a little bit's good. Therefore, let me try more. And we get into areas of what's known as tolerance. The more you experiment, the more you want to experiment. The more you want to experiment, the more you need. That's the problem with micro betting. There's no stop. There's no red light. It just keeps going. That's what we're watching for here, what we're trying to slow down. Because if you take an addictive product, you make it readily available on every phone without guardrails, people are going to get hurt. And unlike other addictions, and again, I don't compare them, there are no warning signs until the person is hemorrhaging. In my clinical practice, nobody walks into my office, Byron. They crawl in. And that's where this big gap is. People are getting hurt, and families aren't learning about it until a lot of damage has taken place. Or parents are trying to just bail their children out. All right, our kids lost a little bit of money. Let's get them out of debt. And what they don't realize is they're actually enabling. They're enabling because they're making the problem go away temporarily, but that tolerance quotient is going to bring it right back and then more. That's what I worry about with younger audiences.
If you were a parent of a young man today who was, say, 17, 18, 20 years old dealing with this, tell us a little bit about how you would handle conversations with your son. And if your son were starting to engage in this and there were a couple of warning signs, what would those warning signs be and what would you do?
I addressed this, and I was on CBS Sunday Morning with Ted Koppel recently. During the course of the interview, Ted Koppel told me what got him interested in the story. And what got him interested was he was doing something he did every weekend, watching sports with three of his grandchildren. And they had their head down on their phones the whole time, betting on everything. It's not for me to, I can't nor will I tell parents that you should permit your children of any age to be exposed to a known addictive product. But each parent's going to address this in their own way. I don't think teenage men and women are equipped mentally to handle the way sports gambling works today. So I'm not going to suggest to any parent they should do it. You and I both know they're already doing it. So let's have a conversation about it along the lines of, what are you engaged in? Because when you and I were 17 years old, if we were gambling, we were gambling on whether the Texans or the Commanders were going to win the game. We were gambling on the Red Sox and the Yankees. It took 3 hours to get a result. If I'm seeing young men and women who engage in these micro betting products, there's no way to describe them other than they're constantly seeking action. And under any barometer, Byron, that's problematic. It's not the money, it's the action. And I would have a very serious conversation along the lines of, is there any scenario where any 17-year-old would agree that constantly pushing another drink in front of you every 15 seconds would be safe? We would all agree that's not safe. This is no different. Yeah. So I'm not going to tell your audience how to parent their children. I'd rather educate your audience that if your children are betting on sports, it's highly unlikely they're betting on the Yankees and the Red Sox and waiting 3 hours. What they're doing is they're engaged in an addictive product, rapid fire. And that is going to cause a level of harm. It's not recreational. And that's the conversation I would have. Because your children are going to tell you, oh, we're just doing it for fun. I've yet to be able to understand or have any patient tell me what's enjoyable about betting on every serve in a tennis match. Frankly, I would suggest the conversation is this making sports more fun or is it making it less fun? I always enjoyed watching tennis serves, Byron. I always enjoyed the competition of it. It's a unique experience. Think about tennis. It's such a unique sport. It's two people or four people on either side of a net with just their physical skills. When did it become we need action to make that enjoyable? Those are the conversations I would start having.
What are some of the bright spots out there for you? What hope do you have about the path forward?
That wherever I go speak, whether it was Woodbury, and I hope to be back there again one of these days, I was at St. Joseph's University last week. I've been in, I think, just this calendar year, I've been in 16 states doing presentations. When I open up to a discussion of a public health approach to make it safer, an overwhelming majority of people want to be involved in that. And I can give you a little breaking news, if you want, as we wind down. I was in New York yesterday finishing up some final things. My organization is about to launch a brand new 501c3, not for profit in any way at all, 501c3 called FOG, Families and Friends of Gamblers. It's going to be the Mothers Against Drunk Driving for Gambling. We're going to pull in all of these concerned family members who may have suffered harm related to someone else's gambling, and we're going to bring them into a movement to make this safer. We're not trying to stop anyone from gambling. We're trying to make it safer. So, Byron, the answer to your question is, and watch for FOG. We'll be introducing it very soon. The answer to the question is November 6th in Washington, D.C. is lifting the FOG day. And the thing that warms me the most, excites me the most, when I talk about this, people say, yeah, that makes sense. Let's get involved and let's make this safer so our children and our brothers and sisters and our parents can enjoy this, but enjoy it from a public health, public safety first perspective. We've done it with alcohol. We've done it with tobacco. We've done it with opioids. We've done it with pharmaceuticals. We've done it with automobiles. We can do it with gambling.
That is a great place to stop, Harry. I really appreciate you joining the podcast. This is such a timely issue for all Americans, and certainly for those of us in the business of educating boys and young men and caring for them. In our vernacular here at Woodbury, to know, challenge, and love them. I really appreciate your time this afternoon, and thanks for being in the Tiger Nation this past spring. Good luck with all of your work. I hope we stay in touch, and one day we'll certainly have you back here in the Tiger Nation. So thank you, Harry.
Been my pleasure. Look forward to seeing you again soon, Byron.
Okay, go Tigers, and thanks everybody for joining the podcast.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Woodbury Podcast. We hope you found our discussion insightful and engaging. And if you enjoyed today's episode, please consider subscribing, rating, or leaving a review on your favorite podcast platform. Stay tuned for more conversations in the future. And remember, the conversation doesn't have to end here. Connect with us on Woodbury Forest School social media, reach out with your questions or comments, and let's keep the dialogue going. Until next time, take care and go Tigers!